The fifth real attribute, strength of the Articles of Confederation, is it allowed the colonies to regulate Native American affairs. Or if you were to ask Native Americans in our modern, sophisticated, politically correct times, we call them, Native Americans would prefer the term Indian affairs. It allowed the Continental Congress, it allowed the to regulate Indian affairs, which basically meant make sure we have a boundary. Very different from our own contemporary concern with Native American affairs, which is basically if Dave goes to Cherokee and wins too much at the casino, then he's kicked out and forced to go home because he's broken the tribal laws for you can only win $1 million a night. You know, so Dave has to go home. But we're talking about basic protection, basic dividing lines with Native American populations, as well as how we're going to treat Native American populations that may be found within the borders of the United States. And indeed, there were many cases of this, as there are today, many Native American populations within the border of the United States, which are still a significant concern for this country.
Right.
Yes, very loosely. But the states are given kind of a veto on anything that the national government does, which is a question we'll come back. Very good point. Sixth, and probably the most important consideration, the most important strength under the Articles of Confederation, is that the national government is allowed, and again, national government in parentheses, national, very loose national government, okay? Very loose. Somebody asked me how loose it was once. I said it was so loose. It's so loose that even the Continental Congress didn't know how loose. Okay. Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed that. Slight note of hilarity. I knew I'd get you to laugh somehow. Having a post office was the sixth and probably the most important and enduring strength of the Articles of Confederation. Now, there are still some problems. Having a national post office is or at least some nationally or collectively facilitated post office is very important. The exchange of information, the exchange of goods by mail. I mean, we tend not to think very much of the post office. That, you know, it's okay, you know, we use it sometimes. Bills come in the post office, anthrax, love letters. People used to send love letters. People used to send, I still do, to my wife, not to other people. Not like some people, just send them. Love letters, cards, communication is still very, very important. The mail is, there's something very special about written communication and about written transactions. This is the records of transactions, and this is one of the major ways that it was taken, it took place. The problem is back to the question we've already been raised. How did it work? Well, there are problems with how it worked because individual states maintained their roads. And so if you're mailing a letter from Georgia to North Carolina, the quality of mail service in large part depended on roads in South Carolina. Therefore, if roads in South Carolina stunk, if they were almost impassable, then you had a potentially national problem. Although now that's misleading to even use that term, nation. Some powers, on the other hand, were exclusive state powers. In fact, most powers ultimately were state powers. And it encourages us to think of the problem of dividing the political power itself, which in political science we call sovereignty. Sovereignty as ultimate power. Where does ultimate power reside? In America, we tend to think of, in our sophisticated 21st century idea, we tend to think of it being in the people. But in the Articles of Confederation, Article number 2 is unambiguous in this regard. Power resides, sovereignty resides in the states. According to the Articles of Confederation, sovereignty can't be divided. It belongs in the states. Although, as we'll see soon in the Constitution, especially in the work and the writings of James Madison, there is the idea and belief that sovereignty can indeed be divided between the national and state governments. But there is a stream within American political thought, American political life, that says sovereignty can't be divided. Even today, that the states are the primary building blocks of this republic. In fact, in opposition to James Madison, even in his own day, after the Constitution is convention, after it's ratified, 19th century America, Jefferson's cousin, John Randolph, who we'll be reading a few things from later, John Randolph will say, when Madison raises this point, well, we're partly federal, partly national, we're divided. Randolph will say, sovereignty is like virginity, to paraphrase him. There is no dividing. There is no separation. Sort of like being, whether you're, whether you have a cold or not, either you have a cold or you don't have a cold, according to John Randolph, who will challenge. So we have this defense of a unified view of sovereignty throughout American political life, as well as the sort of Madisonian vision, which we sort of accept without much criticism or much thought. But you have in the Articles a unified view of sovereignty, and it belongs, including Article 2, without reservation, in the states. Okay. Two powers that the states have, unambiguously and alone, power of taxation. States do the taxing. The federal government, one of the cardinal weaknesses and one of the old kind of introduction to American history, introduction to American politics kind of truisms, there's no national taxation in the Articles. That's what historians and political scientists have cried about for generations. And it's a true point. It's overplayed, probably less important than they make it out, but there isn't a national form of national taxation, which is going to be very problematic, no question about it. But there are a lot of other considerations as well. States also reserve the complete right to regulate commerce, to regulate trade between and among states. These are the powers that the states take from Parliament. Which leads us to a kind of natural question. How did this national government raise funds from the states? They were dependent upon the states' donations of funds, in other words. The states giving them money. That's how it worked. Each state paid a certain amount to the operation of the Confederacy. The states could say, oh, we're having a bad year. Maybe we won't pay as much as we did last year. Jennifer.
Is there any international trade going on?
Yes, yes, even with the mother country. And the entity that would make treaties in that regard was the Continental Congress. But when you have this system of sovereignty, the states, at the end of the day, have a veto. The states have a veto on the national government. It's a very good thing to ponder. There is trade. There is some dispute over trade. I mean, in fact, it's a dispute. One of the main disputes that's going to provoke the Declaration, this change of sympathy, will be trade. So trade is a very big issue. In fact, there are historians and political scientists who, towards the end of the 20th century and beginning of the 21st century, will argue that economics is really the primary factor in this. I don't believe in that purely economic view of things, but it's an important point. Okay, so money is raised from state appropriations. States are paying the bills, which, when you're completely dependent upon the states to pay the bills, if you're this Continental Congress, it becomes a little tricky. It becomes way too tricky at some point. Okay, let's talk about some aspects of this system of government under the Articles.